KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, April 8th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. When their relationship turns sour, a couple undergoes a medical procedure to have each other erased from their memories.
I'm erasing you and I'm happy! You did it to me first! I can't believe you did this to me!
Again, that's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, showing Monday, April 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland, and the bike show is coming up next. Good morning and welcome to The Bike Show, broadcasting from KBOO Studio in Portland, Oregon on 90.7 FM and streaming live on KBOO.org.
My name is Alon Robb and I'm joined in the studio by April Streeter. Good morning, April. How are you today?
Feeling fairly springy.
Our engineer is Heather McCoy. Good day to you, Heather. Today's show centers on some of the good work that is being done in the Pacific Northwest to promote cycling safety and enjoyment. In the first half of the show, we will speak with Barb Chamberlain, head of the Active Transportation Division, Washington State Department of Transportation. In the second half of the hour, we will be joined by Mayor Mark Gamba, the mayor of Milwaukee, Oregon. Before we introduce our first guest, a few news items from the cycling universe.
So I'm going to start with an inspiring story that comes from the Guardian newspaper of the UK about Amsterdam's 9-year-old bike mare, Lotte Krok, the city's junior bike mare. The position was created in order to better express the experiences of children who cycle. Bicycle mares are a global initiative by the Amsterdam-based bike advocacy group, BYCS. Krok was appointed after she won a competition for her idea to create a bike share bike specifically for kids or children. She got the idea while traveling by train and realized that there was never a public bike available for her when she and her family disembarked, and she had to ride on the back of her dad's bike, which is unsafe. The railway system that runs the public bike program offered to put a bike at the station near her home, but she refused, saying, "I'm not bicycle mayor for myself, but for all children in Amsterdam." Krok will help advise the adult bicycle mayor on how to make the city safe for its 125,000 children. She also wants to create a bicycle park in the city for children to learn to ride, so they don't have to learn in dangerous streets. She also urged Amsterdam to be more bold, like Oslo in Norway, which banned cars in its city center. And I say, way to go, Lotta. And now, a little bit less inspiring story today on a more somber note. An Australian study conducted by researchers at Monash University found that 31% of the 442 respondents in Victoria, including some that were cyclists, viewed cyclists as less than human. Participants were asked to identify whether they were cyclists and non-cyclists, and all were given the classic evolution of ape to man image, or an adapted version showing the stages of evolution from cockroach to human. The research, reported in the Transportation Research Part F, Traffic Psychology and Behavior Journal, also found that dehumanization of people who cycle is linked to self-reported aggression towards them. 17% of participants said they used their car to deliberately block a cyclist. 11% had deliberately driven their car close to a cyclist, and 9% had used their car to cut off a cyclist, which probably thinking about reporting, those numbers are a little low. On the positive side, though, the study found that if drivers can put a human face to cyclists, this can reduce aggression. And now back to you, Alon.
Okay, and our first guest is Barb Chamberlain, Director of the Active Transportation, Washington State Department of Transportation. Ms. Chamberlain has also served in the Idaho House and Senate, worked in the academic world, and led bicycle advocacy organizations. As she states on her very interesting blog, when asked to describe my career in 6 words, I said, always doing work I believe in. Good morning, Ms. Chamberlain, and all the best to you. And I want to assure you that we view you as human, as maybe even more than human. So good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good. I have all of my blood circulating and my brain oxygenated because I rode to work this morning.
All right. That's awesome. Well, before I ask my first question, I do want to mention your blog, which is bikestylespokane.com. So go there if you'd like to read some of Barb's musings on bicycling. And I'd like to know your background. How did you become what I like to call a bicyclist?
Thank you for saying bicyclist or person who rides a bike. I have a story that is typical of folks who come from a certain background, and I want to be really clear that when I talk about my experience, I don't assume my experience is universal. Not everybody has the opportunities that I've had, but I did grow up in a house where they could teach me to ride a bike, they could afford to buy a new one when I outgrew one, and so I did that kind of kid recreation biking, and I remember feeling very adventurous when I rode my yellow 10-speed to school, and I lived out in the country, and it was a country school, and then years later I went back and looked on Google Maps, and it was all of a mile and a half, so boy, was I a bold adventurer. But, you know, over the years, I would say I rode my bike at times, sometimes for utility, more often for recreation, pulling kids in a bike trailer kinds of things, and ultimately ended up living in the city of Spokane, and the city put a bike lane in front of my house. And so I would say the trigger for me really to turn from somebody who occasionally rides to somebody who rides as my preferred form of transportation was an infrastructure story. That was the trigger that said, yeah, we have a, you know, a special line of magic paint right there, and that makes that space yours.
That's pretty awesome. And then that you end up working for the Washington State Department of Transportation is kind of interesting. Because weren't they in charge of striping that lane that was in front of your house?
Well, that would have been the city at the time.
Okay.
But we partner with local jurisdictions.
Mm. Okay.
By extension.
So what is the Active Transportation Program?
Well, we got created 2 years ago, and it's really exciting to be in this position, in this agency, in this state at this time. I believe that I'm sort of a unicorn, and I say that because as we've looked around the country at how other state departments of transportation are organized, they will have a person who is designated as a state bicycle and pedestrian coordinator, is a pretty common title because the Federal Highways Administration says you have to have one of those. They are often housed inside a larger unit that is focused on other things. So they're inside planning or public transportation sometimes, local programs. They're just inside a box with a different label at the top. And Washington State made a conscious decision saying our goal as a state agency is to work for an integrated multimodal transportation system. Every other mode is represented in a specific level in the organization. So we have a division of aviation and public transportation and rail freight and ports. And of course, multiple divisions focused on the traditional kind of construction, design, and delivery activities. And so they created the division out of whole cloth. There were people doing work within the local programs division on our grant buckets, and those buckets moved into my division. But to be in this position and starting up a whole new division from scratch has been really exciting. It's been an opportunity to lead us into that future that everybody's working towards.
I would like to ask about that, but first I think maybe we should just define very quickly active transportation. So I'm imagining biking and walking, but there are probably a few I'm missing.
Yes, and it's kind of an expanding portfolio these days. I rode an e-bike to work this morning, I should say. So, and it's a 50-pound bike, and it's more work than riding my road bike, to be honest, but easier on the hills. So we include small-wheeled, rideable devices, and that's a bit of a mouthful, but as we think about what we are planning for and what we want to start counting in terms of transportation usage and demand, that we will look at things like scooters, skateboards, you know, who knows what's being invented tomorrow?
Right.
You have Segways and solo wheels, and I'm sure some venture capitalist is thinking of something new and
to
shiny.
Add to the list.
Yeah, okay. Whatever it is, you know, it's a small human-scaled device. It has different form factors, but it's one that today wouldn't exist comfortably necessarily on a sidewalk, where you have folks who are expecting to move at walking pace, you have people with disabilities, people who cannot see what's coming at them, that kind of thing. And then you have the bike lane, where you have riders of different abilities and different kinds of bikes moving at different speeds. And then you have a vehicle lane with cars in it. And so figuring out where these new things belong and where everybody can be comfortable and coexist, I think, is one of the emerging challenges for those of us working in this space.
Okay.
And what does the job involve daily? What do you do in the office or in the field?
Oh, such a long list of interesting things. We are a division of three, so yes, we're committed. We use the phrase small but mighty a lot in my office. So we work centrally on policy change. What is it that is old practice or old policy that just doesn't take into account the fact that we do want to plan for all modes of transportation, and work on those kinds of things? We, in the region offices, we have people who are identified as a point of contact for these same kinds of questions. It's not their full-time job. It's, you know, one of a long list of duties. So we have brought them together as a team to talk about the kinds of things they run into. Where do we need policy improvements? So that's one big piece. We are updating the state active transportation plan this year and spending a lot of time on that, and working on a number of initiatives where it helps to have a division that focuses just on this. So we have a new pedestrian safety action plan that we developed with help from Federal Highways Administration, working now on, we have pulled together a work group to talk about speed management for minimizing injuries, that we know from national studies that speed, relative speed, not just speeding, but driving at a speed that is not appropriate for the mix of people and uses around you, that is a major contributor to collisions and serious injuries and fatalities. And so we can spearhead these kinds of work groups and conversations to develop new policy to really change what we do as an agency, and then we're providing leadership in that way to the local jurisdictions that look to the state DOT to say, what is it we should be doing to make the road safer for everybody?
So I have found, and that's definitely just from my own perspective, though, that departments of transportation have a, if we were going to describe it in just a few words, an engineering and road building mentality. And so it was fascinating to me that in your job description it says to lead the integration of active transportation modes into Washington State Department of Transportation culture. And so I'd like to ask you about how you have experienced the culture in the 2 years that you've been there, and maybe if you have any short example of how you can shift culture within an organization. I think that's a very difficult thing to do.
Oh, it is, and there are only 7,100 people, so, you know, no big.
Gosh.
All state departments of transportation used to be called the State Department of Highways, and
yes,
all of the funding, reward structures, professional recognition, ribbon cuttings, everything revolved around those big projects. What the head of every state DOT would tell you today is that the highway system, as the state highway, is pretty much all but built out, that there is no more available right-of-way. We don't want to take people's homes and pave over, and you know that if you did that, it's going to fill up with drivers anyway, and you have no more functional capacity than you had when you started. And so more highways are not the solution to moving more people and moving more freight to market. And so they acknowledge it, they think about it. It is hard to make that shift over to the question, so what do we do now then?
Mm.
And so I think that's the challenge everybody's facing. I think the folks who want to make change more quickly work to bring along colleagues who have been rewarded for years for that other set of activities. It's not easy, and I would say a lot of times the funding doesn't align easily to make that possible in the very short term. So we might have been funded 10 years ago, two transportation revenue packages back, to build an interchange. We don't get to just move that money over and build bike trails instead. That would be breaking state law.
Mm-hmm.
And so we continue to execute on projects that were developed and scoped and funded under that, what I would say is the previous mindset. So we have sort of two streams of things going forward. So that is the challenge in front of anybody working on this in any level of government, really. There's a lot of energy in our agency. It comes from the top. The Secretary of Transportation, Roger Millar, walks to work. And apparently, occasionally, a WSDOT employee will see him and stop and offer him a ride. And he says, no, this is how I get to work.
Yeah.
And so all of us in leadership are meeting with people all the time. We do presentations. That can feel kind of dry, but they are hearing from leadership that this is the direction this agency is going. One of the things I've focused on is communicating both internally and externally, partly just what we do as an agency. In Spokane, for example, we're building a completely separated trail next to a new section of highway. And so the Children of the Sun Trail is a state DOT project. And so we should recognize and take credit for those things that we are doing, or where we improve a crossing or whatever it is. So being thanked, I think, is a part of culture shift. You do something new, we would reward it. I had kids. You want to recognize good behavior when you see it. And then I talk a lot about the words that we use, because when we say traffic, if by that we actually mean motor vehicle traffic, and if by that we really, really mean people who are driving alone and that's why there's so much traffic, then we should be clear about that, because then we start to see the problem differently so we can work for different solutions. So I work a lot on, I would say, sort of multimodal usage and clarity around what's in front of us and what we can do about it.
You are listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon, on 90.7 FM and streaming live on KBO.org. We're talking with Barb Chamberlain, Director of Active Transportation, Washington State Department of Transportation. In her words, a small but mighty unit. You mentioned language, and on your site, one of the things I liked among the 100 things you're accomplishing or trying to accomplish this quarter, you mentioned driving metaphors and how that is used. Can you elaborate a little bit about that?
I will tell everybody my first degrees were in English and linguistics, and I feel like I've looked at words and how we use them all my life, personally and professionally, one way or another. And we embed driving as a good thing throughout our lives in ways we don't even recognize. You know, what's the point you're trying to drive home? Well, there are other ways to express that besides talking about driving.
We were stumped for a minute.
Yeah. You
what's
know,
the point you're bicycling home?
Yeah. We put ideas in a parking lot, except in my meetings where we put them on the bike rack.
Okay.
So you can look for these things, and it can be funny, and people can enjoy it, and they always laugh when I put ideas on the bike rack, but that's a different location, and I would say it's a lot more space efficient, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so helping people clarify these, and it doesn't mean you can't ever use a car reference, but always using that as a positive thing and always talking about being big and going fast is a mindset people then carry when they go out the door and they get behind the wheel and they think, I'm big and I go fast. They aren't thinking about, oh, somebody's who's going to be parking on the bike rack. And so I think highlighting those helps people recognize those things. We do the same thing, by the way, with all kinds of words about other privileged elements of our lives, our demographic descriptions, our
yes.
physical disabilities, any number of ways that we are using metaphors that relate well for some people while they leave other people out entirely. So I think it is part of a larger endeavor, really, to just say, let's talk about everybody, not just some of them.
Which is great, but I'm wondering if you found in that process, have you found a language that you feel really works for the state of bicycling in a very urban area like Seattle, and then over to rural Washington and eastern Washington, where things are much different?
Well, I have to try to come up with a different metaphor. And I did write a blog post a while ago about making bike networks was like making soup. And I like to cook, and everybody likes to eat. So that's maybe a little more universal experience. They may or may not be good cooks, but you know you start with what you have in the pantry.
Mm-hmm.
And it may take one form or another depending on what you can throw in there. And I'm especially fond of making soup, so that's why it was soup. But you can make stew or, you know, a tossed salad, whatever works for you as a metaphor, that you start with the ingredients you have, and you know where you want to get to, and you work towards that. And if you remember the childhood fable that some people grew up with, stone soup, if everybody adds their bit to it, it's a better soup by the end of it. So you can extend that to talk about what happens when the city Department of Transportation brings its ingredients. I got to ride today in a beautiful protected bike lane and on a separated trail and on things that were very comfortable and low-stress sections. Now, State Department of Transportation didn't actually enter into my route today, but if we did and you had to cross a state highway, what ingredient are we adding to the bike soup here so that it's tasty for everybody? Not too hot, not too cold, just right, so that you can get across where you need to. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, if you have fun with it and you ask people to use their creativity, draw a picture, tell a story, sing a song if that's your thing, you go to a different place in your creative sparks about what it is we're trying to do. If you always use metaphors that reward large, heavy, fast movement, you will plan for a large, heavy, fast movement.
Mm-hmm. And you worked in government, then you were working, directing a bicycle advocacy group, and now you're back in government. What are some of the challenges, for example, in building consensus, working in government?
That's a great question, so I pause for a second, because there are many challenges to building consensus when you're not in government, too. And I think I go back to people being people. You bring your private self or your philanthropic self or your, you know, good-spirited social volunteer self into your work life, too. So it ends up being kind of the same. There are some specific requirements, certainly, around public engagement and the responsibility for making sure that we are accessible to all in the materials we put out, for example, that people might not do in their day-to-day lives, although I wish they would. So there's that. There's being very conscious all the time that I represent the public interest and that I have responsibilities that go with that. Mm. And that's a path I've followed most of my life. I either was, you know, I was in elected office or I was working in government or I was running a nonprofit and I'm back working in government. I have always, I love that you found my six-word description, always doing work I believe in, that I want to be accountable for what I do and who I represent and how I make the world a better place through my actions. And I think that's a high bar, but it's one that I take great pleasure in going for.
Mm, very admirable, too. So I love this from your recent blog. It's from this research brief that the happiest mode of transportation, that would be cycling, or I would change it to that would be bicycling. Mm-hmm. Based on these findings, FAN recommends transportation planners promote cycling, currently used by about 1% of U.S. commuters, among their citizens and improve transit user experiences. So I'll post later to our Facebook page the link to this study if others, and also to Barb's blog so that other people, you can go and visit. But my question is, what do you think that Washington State DOT is right now doing? I mean, maybe you won't be able to contain yourself to one, but what do you feel are the most effective ways that you're currently promoting bicycling?
Well, we will be reaching out all over the state this year because we're updating the state active transportation plan and asking people to get involved, and not just in our state plan. We feel that a state plan can be pretty abstract. It can feel pretty far away from your front door. And your decision to ride and to feel that happiness really starts at your front door or at your point of origin, whatever that might be. And so as we talk to people about what we're planning for, we are trying to give them the tools to, I guess, speak the language as they go into whether it's a city council meeting or a bike master plan update process or engaging with regional planning. Let's talk about what makes a good, complete, comfortable set of connections, because we need to see that in local plans so that we can connect to that in state plans. And when we do that, when we stop worrying quite so much about who owns what and talk more about, can you get to where you're going from beginning to end, or do you have a complete set of connections? That's a really important question, and it's a question that's already been asked and answered for drivers, or it just kind of happened. Like, if you start to drive, you don't have to worry that you're going to get stuck on a highway and there's no way to get off it forever. And
no.
We never build a highway segment without building on and off ramps.
Right.
But we will build a chunk of something all the time, whether it's bike lanes or sidewalk segments or, you know, trails being built incrementally a bit at a time. And bless the advocates who keep at it year after year with that vision until you have a finished trail, because it takes decades. So I think helping people see that this is, there is something in this for all of us, and we have to work at every level to bring it together, that that's a big piece of what we're trying to do as an agency. And especially, I mentioned earlier, the smaller rural towns, where they also make very good soup, by the way, often they look to the state DOT design manual, to our policies. They don't have a big staff to go out and worry about this and think about it and come up with stuff. So we really need to provide good leadership in this respect to help them do better. And those are the places, and certainly Oregon has illustrated this, where bike tourism can make a big difference to the local economy. So yes, that's another piece of what we talk about, is there is a very real economic value to being bike friendly and being connected to the next town over.
Yes. Hmm.
My wonderful daughter lives in the woods outside Olympia, about 40 minutes from Olympia. And when I cycle there, I notice, obviously there are no lanes, and it's a little dangerous over there. And I found also during conversations with people at the local store that attitudes to cyclists, or sometimes, I don't want to generalize too much because there are exceptions, but a little challenging for me. So I'm wondering, what is the state of cycling in rural Washington, and what could be done, or what is being done?
Well, I think you're right when you say it varies person to person.
Yeah.
When you work in my line of work for any time, length of time, or actually maybe for 2 days, somebody will stop you and tell you about this person on a bike who did something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a thing they don't like. And I almost always get a laugh if I say, you know, I have found that there is a universal jerk constant. And the jerk constant uh-huh. actually applies across all modes. And they laugh and they think about it. And I say, so if you're telling me that person rolled a stop, have you ever seen a person driving a car roll a stop? We called it a California stop when I was growing up in Idaho. And they, when you ask them to think about the universality of human behavior, they can acknowledge that. It's harder to remember that when that's a thing you don't engage in, that's an other to you. And so it's very easy to say, see the other, remember the other, talk about the other. They're not going to describe me, who did everything right on mm-hmm. my way as I biked past them. Like, I'm invisible at that point. And mm-hmm. so that's one person at a time. That's not a wholesale strategy. I would say also, in all of my presentations and the talks I give, I try very hard to stress that there is something in this for everyone. If we design a street that has a space for everyone to be in, that is clear, that tells you who's going to do what at the intersection, that gives you what you need to see as a driver, but when you're going to make that turn, you don't want to run into somebody. You want to know they're in the crosswalk. So there is something in it for you. We need to move away from saying that we're doing these things for people who walk or roll. We're doing these things for everybody, and that includes in those rural spaces. Your daughter needs to move to where she's connected to the Chehalis Western and the Woodland Trails, because that is delightful to bike. And you come from the Amtrak station into downtown Olympia, and you have trail and bike lane all the way to the coffee shop.
Wow, that sounds
yeah.
pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So I love your bike it bucket list, and I encourage people to go to your blog and read through that bucket list. So I'm just going to give a few of that you've put into this bucket list to inspire people, because in the theme of this show for me was inspiration. I was feeling a little uninspired in the biking world, and so I wanted to get some more inspiration, and you've definitely provide some, especially with this bucket list. So number one, learn how to repair a flat tire, which reminded me I need to up my skills. I do know how to, but it's something that if you don't do it a lot, and I don't, you need to repractice. Learn how to tune your bike, but then ride as many miles as you are years old. I love that one. And volunteer for an organization that helps people enjoy bicycling who aren't able to do it on a regular bicycle. And then lastly, review state laws and local ordinances about bicycling so you really know the law. That sounds super boring, but I still do love that you put that in there, because it is always a surprise to learn some of the rules that we should be following that we not necessarily know. So I just wondered if, from your bucket list in the first quarter of 2019, if you've accomplished anything from that list, and if so, what?
Oh, I'd have to go back and look at the whole list to know what I've done. I think I said something about riding different kinds of bikes, and the fact that I got an e-bike, it
yeah.
wasn't my first ever time to be on one, because I had ridden one, like a teeny tiny ride around a parking lot sort of ride, but to really ride distances on an electric bicycle and to feel what that does for my bicycling that's different and that I love. So now I know I can bike until I'm like 98 years old.
Which is cool. So talk a little bit about that experience, because I think that electric bikes are one of the areas where we really could expand the world of cyclists who are able and feel comfortable and feel happy and experience the joy. I mean, I've felt like that since 2013 when I really thought the electric bikes were going to take off, and it's been much slower. So what has been your experience with the e-bike?
Well, one of the things I tell people is it doesn't necessarily make me faster. It makes it easier. And so because I am living in hilly Seattle, my pattern before was I would bike to work, and I've got quiet neighborhood streets, a trail, a pretty busy freight movement corridor, but that one's got a bike lane and I can ride on the sidewalk if I need to for a while. Like, I've got a full set of connections and I know that route. Turn around and go home the other direction, I have to use a slightly different route to go home, and the hills actually are different hills and steeper hills on the way home. This is a trick. Somebody turned them around when I wasn't looking. And so my tendency at the end of the day when I've been kind of tired is I'll throw my bike on the bus and go home, and I, you know, ride the under a mile from the bus stop to my house. So I still ride, but it's not the same level of effort. With my e-bike, the first day I got it, I rode home, and I had ridden home a few times before, so I know there are these hills where I might say, you know what, I'm not a highly fit athlete. I'm going to get off and push my bike up the hill, and there's no shame in that. I'm getting home. That's fine. And instead, I had this just gentle sensation like having a hand in the small of your back, giving you a little boost up the hill.
Oh, I remember that. Yes.
Yes, it feels just like that. And I rode all the way home and went, wow, that is the most miles I've done in a day for a while. And then the next day, I rode all the way and all the way home. So immediately, substantially increasing my mileage, I think,
yes,
is the biggest piece.
Yes.
The other piece is my usual bike. It has been a road bike, and I really prefer the upright posture of the city bike. I feel happier. It's less stressful on my neck, shoulders, and back. And yes, for those who do bike fitting, I've been fitted. We've tweaked the handlebar. We've done all kinds of things on the road bike. And nonetheless, an upright posture is just happier for me personally. And so to have that along with the boost up the hill, I know I will ride more places more often because I have that.
Okay, we're going to wrap it up now, but I just wanted to add one thing to your list, which was the ability to negotiate intersections. I found that with an e-bike, that ability to negotiate an intersection where there are pedestrians and bicyclists and cars, just that little bit of e-bike boost, it gives you a lot more confidence in intersections. And I'm going to hand it over now to Alon, who's going to wrap things up. Thanks so much.
The time just went by so fast. You're listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon. We have been speaking with Barb Chamberlain, Director of Active Transportation, Washington State Department of Transportation. Thank you, Barb, for being on the show, for your good work, and also for that suggestion of making soup today. That's what I'll do today, and I'll think of you.
All right.
Thank you so much. In the second half of the show, we will be joined by Mayor Mark Gamba of Milwaukee, Oregon, who just zoomed into the station here, parked his electric bike, and we're glad to have him.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. I thought we were going to take a little music break, but we're here, so we'll... There we go.
Takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle, let's get together to pedal and roam. You can take a ride up in Forest Park. You can ride with the light if you ride in the dark. You can ride from the mountain down to the beach. You can ride on a trail, you can ride in the street. You can ride through a puddle, you ride in the rain. You can take it on a bus, you can take it
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon, and available also as a podcast. In the studio are April Streeter and Alone Robb. Our engineer is Heather McCoy. And we are joined now by Mayor Mark Gamba of Milwaukee, Oregon, described by the excellent BikePortland.org website as being the loudest political voice for bicycling in our region. We are happy to have Mayor Gamba in the studio and find out if he's also the most effective voice besides being the loudest. So good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, before we start, we're talking about bicycling. For those of our listeners who think that Milwaukee is only located in the state of Wisconsin, can you please tell us about Milwaukee, Oregon? What distinguishes it? What is unique about it?
Sure. Milwaukee is actually on the southern border of Portland. We're just across the county line in Clackamas. We're the orange line ends, if you're a TriMet person. Milwaukee has been a blue-collar industrial town since it sort of phased away from being a farm town. It's the famous Bing Cherry comes from Milwaukee, where Seth Lewelling had his experimental orchards. It's a town of about 22,000 people. The demographic is changing rapidly due to the gentrification that we're experiencing all over the metro region. It's one of the many things that my council is working hard to try and forestall a little bit. I don't know. What else would you like to know about Milwaukee?
Well, I'd like to know when you moved there, what was the reason for moving there? What were your early cycling experiences either prior to living there or in Milwaukee itself?
Well, early cycling experiences, I grew up on a bike. I've been riding a bike as long as I can remember, and biked to school until the day I got my driver's license when I was 16. And even then, I still would ride my bike pretty regularly to school and to work. Moved to Milwaukee. We had our kids in the Waldorf school down in Bend. We helped start that Waldorf school, and okay, it wasn't growing as fast as our kids were, so right, it wasn't keeping up with the classes. So we looked around at a lot of cities on mostly the West Coast that had full K-12 Waldorf schools, and settled on the Portland Waldorf School, which happens to be in Milwaukee.
Okay.
Literally was lucky to find a house two blocks north of the school, so my kids walked to school their entire school career. And I was still riding my bike when I got to Milwaukee. Not as often. My trade is a photographer. I used to shoot for National Geographic. I used to shoot for a bunch of different commercial entities like Adidas and Carhartt. So very often I was driving, my 4Runner full of camera gear, uh-huh, someplace. But back then it was really more for recreation and occasionally to run an errand or something. I got into politics because of climate change, mm-hmm, and as I've become a fiercer advocate for the things we need to be doing around climate change, I've been walking my talk. I've been riding my bike. So most of the meetings I attend in the Portland metro region, I do so by bike, whether it's raining or not. And it's an electric bike now. That was the change I had to make going from being a city councilor to being the mayor. As a city councilor, you attend far fewer meetings, and they are further apart in the day. So my salsa mariachi was sufficient for getting me around to those meetings. But as the mayor, I have several meetings. I just came from a health event down at Harmony Campus in Clackamas, Clackamas Community College, where I was one of the speakers on the panelists and would not have made it had I been on the mariachi.
Okay.
So now I'm riding a class 3 e-bike, which in many cases in the Portland metro region, I can beat somebody in a car.
Hmm. That's pretty impressive. Can you tell the listeners what you mean by class 3?
E-bikes have limiters on them that sort of stop assisting you at a certain speed. And typically across the board, most of those, it's at 20 miles an hour. The class three bikes, it's at 27 miles an hour, which doesn't sound like a big difference, but what it does allow me to do is to safely and comfortably take the lane on a 35 mile an hour street.
That's cool.
And that has made a huge difference. It also, you know, in the instances where I could be going 22, you know, that's a few more minutes shaved off a trip. Even, you know, when I'm in more of a cycling space.
Okay.
And you mentioned working as a photographer, and indeed on the web I was able to find some beautiful and powerful images of animals, fish. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, that career, and also how is that connected to climate? Is it the disappearance of wildlife?
Sure.
Yeah.
So I was reminded of this. A college classmate a while back sent me an email. I hadn't seen him since college, and he said, "You did it. We all wanted to shoot for National Geographic, but you actually did it." So it was my childhood dream to shoot for them, and it took a while. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of a circuitous route. I was shooting for Sports Illustrated before I was shooting for National Geographic. My route sort of just. Life does the things life does to you, right? So I ended up shooting a lot of sports and adventure. I grew up kayaking and ice climbing and rock climbing and skiing and riding horses and doing all the scuba diving. I was the youngest certified scuba diver in Colorado when I got certified. So I've been doing all those things all my life. So kind of in preparation, I always assumed that that's what the National Geographic photographers had to be able to do anything, hike through jungles, you know, whatever. And it turned out that is exactly how I got into Geographic. I became one of those photographers that had a set of skills that allowed me to do assignments that other photographers couldn't do simply because they didn't have that outdoor skill set. And so that was the niche in Geographic, and actually the niche I had with Sports Illustrated and Outside Magazine and others, commercial clients as well. So I did a lot of adventure work for National Geographic, and you're probably thinking of either the hammerhead sharks or the whale shark. Mm-hmm. I love being underwater. It's if I could do anything in the world and I didn't have to care about climate change anymore, I would dive all the time. It's extraordinary, and it's also the thing that breaks my heart the most, besides the fact that my children's lives are at risk, at peril, knowing that by 2040 the oceans will be dead. That miraculous, massive expanse of life, incredibly flourishing life, will be, for all intents and purposes, completely dead if we carry on the way we're carrying on. So it was that. It was seeing the coral reefs bleaching. It was seeing the glaciers disappearing in the mountains. And then speaking to scientists and understanding what their models showed us and what that plays out to. And it's horrific. And you know, there's the young woman in Norway or Sweden,
yes,
or whatever.
Swedish.
Who says, you know, the house is on fire, mm-hmm. and the adults aren't acting like it's on fire.
Right.
And that's the way I felt about it, since I really understood what it was and what it was going to do. And I'm still to this day mystified by most of government and in industry and everybody else who aren't treating this like we treated World War II. Like, change everything we're doing and address this issue. So I went into a tailspin when Al Gore didn't become president. He did not lose the election, he just didn't become president. Because I thought, okay, here's the guy. Finally, we're getting a president who, that is his top priority. He gets it. And we ended up instead with an oil man. I think the world couldn't have gone in a more wrong direction.
Yes.
And I went into a tailspin, into a dark depression, and it really wasn't until I was living in Milwaukee and getting engaged with the community. I was on the bicycle transportation planning group. That was the very first thing I did.
Okay.
As a citizen of Milwaukee. that I realized, wow, I could actually get in this game and maybe start to shift things.
Hmm. So, but now that you're in the game, how does it feel? Because I would imagine that you're representing your constituents. It's a bigger job, and you can't spend quite as much passion time on climate, or can you?
You're right. It's not what I get to spend 100% of my time on. If I'm lucky, it's maybe 10% of my time. There's a lot of intersectionality, though, around some of the other things, mm-hmm. around transportation, around housing, around homelessness, around healthcare, around all those things. There's some intersectionality with climate. So very often the solutions you arrive at to solve one of those is also the solution to something else. Transportation is a classic example. If we make it safer and more convenient to do something besides drive a car, people will do that something.
Yes.
Right? They'll ride a bike, they'll take the bus, they'll take the max. Our society has been designed for the car. It literally is not a society for humans, particularly in America. It's a society designed for the car. And we have to move away from that as quickly as we possibly can, while understanding that it's very convenient and easy for people to do. Hopefully the shift to electric vehicles will take up the slack where we can't in mass transit and cycling.
You are listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon, and our guest in the studio is Mayor Mark Gamba of Milwaukee, Oregon. Mark, give us some examples of what's being done in Milwaukee, concrete steps and actions that, to stop this march towards planetary destruction.
Yeah. So in the very obvious sense, we've passed one of the most aggressive climate action plans in the state for a city, which is a little bit remarkable given the size of our city. Most other cities that have really powerful climate action plans are much bigger than we are, have a bigger staff, have the bandwidth to carry things out. And we've hired a staff member specifically. That's all she works on. So we're doing that. That's the obvious thing. Something that I put into motion while I was still a city councilor, actually, was piggybacking off of parents in the neighborhood's complaints about how they lived four or five blocks from their kid's school, and yet their kid couldn't walk to school because it wasn't safe. There were no sidewalks. And I took that issue, brought it before council as a councilor, and was poo-pooed, and it's going to cost too much, and we can't do that. Never happened. So I worked over the next few years to help get like-minded people elected to the council. Now my council is four women and myself, and we are all of a similar mind that we need to be changing our city to benefit and going after those audacious goals. So as it turns out, once we did the master plan, we had a committee of citizens work on this. And we, with our engineering department, we came up with a master plan of all the sidewalks we need to build, the bike lanes, the bike paths, what were all the things. And that adds up to, I think, around $50 million worth of infrastructure. And we said, okay, how do we pay for that? And we went to another citizen committee and said, figure out how we pay for this. And during this whole process, there was a ton of outreach. We spoke with citizens at the farmers market. We went to the neighborhood district associations. We did every possible way we could get the every person engaged. And some people grumble and complain and bicyclists and all this stuff. But by and large, the community came with us. So that when it finally came down to brass tacks and we passed the plan and then a fee, it's $4.85, goes on the water bill. It's called the safe fee. We got a couple of angry phone calls. That was it.
So you must be surprised, though, that people went along with it. Or were you just, you thought it was the right time and Milwaukee was the right place?
No. Here's something that I've learned, that change moves at the speed of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was that outreach portion. Because even if you disagree, right, even if you're one of the curmudgeons who hates having cyclists on their streets, thinks all children should be driven right to the very door of the school, mm-hmm. because that's what's safest. If you see that kind of outreach and you see that your neighbors think this other thing is a good idea, as long as you've been heard and you understand that you're just in the minority and other people think it's a good idea, they're going to more or less go along. We still have a handful of, you know, the usual.
But cranks.
And more it's about where we're choosing to put the routes rather than that we're actually doing it.
That's
it's
a good thing.
Yeah.
And the personal example you set, riding on your bike, is, I would imagine would have great effect on people's perception of you and of the city and what's possible. You mentioned the bad stuff about, you know, where the oceans are going. In your optimistic days, and you seem to me like an optimistic person by nature, where do you see Milwaukee in 10, 20 years? What kind of city are you envisioning, and how are you moving towards it?
I think it's going to look... it's going to look both very different and feel the same. And that sounds strange, but Milwaukee is a small town. It feels like a small town. When you're there, it's got a small town vibe. That doesn't mean that all the buildings on Main Street are one story. It just means that people know each other and people engage with each other and know what's happening in that neighborhood over there or what's happening. And we have created, I think we may have probably had, but we have nurtured a very engaged citizenry, or I don't like using citizen anymore, residents. Mm. And so that feeling and that aspect of Milwaukee won't change. However, what you're going to see in the downtown is a lot of mixed-use five-story buildings that are green, because that's the only way you get to five stories in Milwaukee. Hmm. You can go to three stories in the downtown by right, do whatever you want, office building, we don't care. If you want that fourth story, you either have to build a green building, which means an energy-efficient building, or you have to have housing in that building. That next floor is the other one. So you can, if you do housing and green, you can go to five stories. And there's one being built right now, there's one that will start construction next year, and there's probably six more in downtown and sort of the central area that are kind of in the planning phases at various levels. So you're going to start to see more of that. You're going to start to see Milwaukee be a very vibrant downtown. When I moved there, the downtown was kind of a ghost town. There really wasn't any place to go. Half the storefronts were empty, or maybe they were an office that you couldn't go in. Yeah. And it's dramatically changing in that way. It's a much more vibrant downtown, and it will continue to head in that direction. We're also doing our comp plan right now. So we are considering, long before the speaker announced her concept around allowing more forms of housing in the neighborhoods, we were already working on that. And we're doing it the hard way through the comprehensive plan process, which is like a 2.5 year, lots of planning, lots of outreach, lots of engagement conversations. And actually on April 18th, we will have our first open house talking about the housing aspect. And our hope is that our citizens will understand and embrace ideas around having cottage clusters in the neighborhoods, or having a fourplex, or maybe a little garden apartment. Those were very common things 100 years ago. What we call SROs now, single room occupancies, were boarding houses. Right. They were everywhere. And that's where you lived if you were a single person with not such a great paying job. You had a home. There aren't places like that anymore.
No, there aren't.
And those people are living in tents now.
Yeah.
Our hope is to start to do that and to create little neighborhood nodes where a little bit of commercial activity happens in each neighborhood, maybe a coffee shop or a bookstore or whatever, a little grocery store, so that there becomes these neighborhood centers that where people can gather, where you can walk to a service that you want instead of having to get in your car and go drive someplace to go have a cup of coffee or grab a beer or something. So that's where Milwaukee's headed. And I think 10 years, it will be there. I think you will see a very different looking city that is potentially even more of a small town from the sense of how much of a community it is.
So maybe you could describe then what it's like to bike in Milwaukee now, and a little bit of that lovely future vision that you're giving, what it will be like to bike in Milwaukee in 10 years.
Sure.
And also maybe riding on a bike to Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so the Portland trip from downtown Milwaukee to downtown Portland right now is sweet. That, with the exception of the Sellwood Gap, that is done. We built the 17th Avenue path that starts there at 99E and goes up and connects to where the Springwater will eventually connect there at 17th.
Okay.
So right now, that's why I can beat anybody in a car during rush hour from Milwaukee City Hall to Portland City Hall, because I can take the Springwater Corridor. So that's an extraordinary piece of infrastructure. It was very forward-thinking of Portland, and I'm excited that we're finally building another section of the Sellwood Gap this summer. In Milwaukee, a lot of the streets are still quiet enough that it's pretty comfortable to ride a bike on. We do have bike lanes on most of our collectors. The three greenways that we have planned are expensive to build. We need to get grants so that fee that I talked about doesn't build our most expensive projects. It builds all our sidewalks, all our safe routes to school, all those things. But the expensive projects like the greenway, like the there'll be a separated bike ped path on Railroad Avenue. Those are going to cost, $4, $5, $6 million, and we will be seeking grants from various pots of money to build those. The first one I suspect we will get built is the Monroe Greenway, which crosses Milwaukee from the river out to the 205 bike path.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect we might see that happen in the next couple, 3 years. But it's not bad to ride around Milwaukee right now. When I got there, it wasn't as good. There weren't as many bike lanes. There were more cranky people in cars, and but it's improved a lot.
Okay. Do you have some more questions that you wanted to ask?
Yeah, our time is almost up, but we have a few more minutes. And, listening to you, of course, I'm reminded of the green energy plan that was proposed in Congress. And
the Green New Deal, yeah.
Yeah, and also, national bike organizations want to add a national bike plan like that. That would be great. And when you consider how much a missile cost or bailing out bankers, I'm wondering if you've been a mayor for several years. Do you have any aspirations for other offices? I noticed there are only about 16 people on the Democratic Party list wanting to be president. are you thinking that you might be more effective on a state level?
Well, I don't aspire quite to the office of president.
Yet.
But
in America, anybody could be president, as we
clearly
see.
Clearly see. I am considering running for a higher office. I'm actually, April 19th is my 60th birthday, and I'm throwing myself a party, inviting 600 or 700 of my closest friends.
Happy birthday.
And I will be making an announcement there, actually, about what my plans are. But I do think, the work that I set out to do in Milwaukee is either done or it's got on a good glide path. Mm. The council I have is extraordinary. There are 3 or 4 potential mayors on that council and another 3 or 4 on our planning commission or in other committees. I have a deep bench. I feel like Milwaukee is in great hands no matter what. And I do believe at this point we've got 11 years to do it. If the federal government does not engage in a big, really aggressive way, like the Green New Deal, we will not solve this problem. And so I am considering playing on a bigger stage.
Okay, so I think we'll close on a biking note, and I'd like to hear, where in Oregon right now is your favorite place to ride for recreation? So you're doing a lot of e-bike riding, but is there still a place that calls you that's more about just wandering?
I wish I had the time to recreate.
Oh, no.
I am trying to remember the last, other than going on a date with my girlfriend on a bike to some restaurant up in Portland or something. I'm trying to remember the last time we just went on a bike ride for a bike ride's sake.
Okay, well, there's a wonderful path in Milwaukee, so maybe your next date you guys have to go out. Isn't the trolley trail right?
Sure, I ride the trolley trail probably six times a month because I have meetings in Clackamas County up on the hill at the Clackamas County. So that's my route south as far as right up to the Clackamas River and then.
Okay.
But yeah, I ride the trolley trail a lot. I ride the Springwater, obviously, in both directions from Milwaukee. Love both of those pieces of infrastructure. I've always wanted to do, there's a ride out towards the coast that I've wanted to do, still haven't done it. I've wanted to do the ride to Hood River in the gorge, still haven't done it. It's
lots of chances coming up.
Yes.
Put it on your bucket list. It's a gorgeous ride. So happy birthday as well.
Thank you.
Happy birthday. You have been listening to The Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBO studio in Portland, Oregon. All shows are available as podcasts on bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. My name is Alon Robb. I would like to thank our very inspiring guests today, Barb Chamberlain and Mayor Mark Gamba of Milwaukee, Oregon. I'd also like to say hello to some of our friends who've been listening in Amsterdam, Cairo, Tel Aviv, Istanbul, London, Barcelona, and Guanajuato, Mexico. Thank you also to my co-host, April Streeter, and to our engineer, Heather McCoy, and all the best in the coming month. Safe, joyful, and enlightening rides.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
It takes two wheels and no gasoline to keep yourself healthy and to keep the air clean. You can ride in the sunshine, you can ride in the rain. It takes two pedals, two wheels and a chain. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam.
KBO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. Challenging the Both Sides Narrative is a talk by Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky. This talk will provide an overview of contemporary fascist and anti-fascist movements with a focus on the key differences between them. Again, that's Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.